It's critically important to our producers to be part of an effective traceability system, not just for what it means for other people, but what it means for them and their future of their farm. So for years, we've been working on this request by industry for traceability to do more, to provide more value back to its users while being effective.
This podcast is brought to you by Dentons. We are the largest law firm in the world with offices in more than 200 locations across 80 countries, available to support you everywhere you do business. We're a law firm that embraces change and can help you grow, protect, operate, and finance your organization, which is why Dentons is organized to offer more than just legal insight. We're here to help you find business solutions in a seamless fashion across the globe.
Hi, I'm Heather Barnhouse, a partner at Dentons, Canada's global law firm. I am also the co-leader of the Venture Technology and Emerging Growth Companies Group in our Edmonton office, and I serve as the national co-leader of our Agribusiness Group. Welcome to another episode of Women in Leadership and Entrepreneurship. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Corlina Patterson, the Executive Director of the Canadian Sheep Federation. In this episode, we're going to dive into sheep and some other animals and the topic of leading an organization in an innovative and a progressive way. Some of the themes that we'll explore include some trends in developing technology in the agriculture space and the bigger implications that those have in our world. Welcome, Corlina. It's so nice that you were able to join us.
Thank you, Heather. It's absolutely my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Great. Well, can you give our listeners a little bit of background about yourself and about Canadian Sheep Federation?
Yeah, sure. So I am the executive director here at the Canadian Sheep Federation, and we're the national advocacy body for Canada's sheep farmers and ranchers. So to put it shortly, we work on policy, politics, and programs as they relate to empowering and supporting our member organizations and the producers across Canada and being sustainable and ideally profitable. And so, that's my role with the CSF, and that's what we do. I'm a mother of two teenagers. So if I look disheveled, good thing this is not on camera, that would be the reason, but they're awesome kids. I've worked and lived agriculture and agribusiness my entire life and career. So it's my passion. I grew up on a farm. I grew up with my family owning Livestock Auction Mart. My undergrad degree is in animal science because from the agriculture perspective, animals and livestock are more my focus. I'm not good at keeping plants alive, so but really good at keeping animals alive. So my undergrad degree is in animal science, and I have a master's degree, which I did only 10 years ago. So when I had two young children and was working full time, which is a terrible, terrible idea, but nonetheless, successfully completed that. And it's from the veterinary school at the University of Edinburgh.
Oh, wow. I have to tell you this little anecdote when you said you're not very good at keeping plants alive. So probably when I was in my undergrad, my mother asked me one time if I would come, she was going on vacation, and would I come and water her plants? And I was like, yeah, okay. And, you know, promptly forgot about doing that until the day before she returned from her vacation. And so I go over to her place and I was like, why are there so many plants here? Like, she never used to have this many plants. And anyway, so there I am, like, madly watering all these plants, and they're all in these pots that are sitting on the, like, on the floor, on the carpet, and like on furniture. Like, they're everywhere. They're absolutely everywhere. So I just dutifully, like, water, like it takes me like an hour to water all these plants. She comes home the next day and she is fuming because it turns out that only one of those plants was real and all the rest of them were fake plants, but I was too dumb to be able to tell the difference. And so really what I did was create a mess because these pots weren't, like, I don't know, they had holes in them. And so this fake dirt, I made all this mess all over the carpet on her return. I was never asked again to water her plants. And so I think you and I are equally skilled at not keeping plants alive, but you have the added benefit over me that you are able to, you know, work with animals. She never asked me to do that. And I also was never asked again to water her plants.
Yeah. And I mean, given the plant experience, it's feasible. She wouldn't ask you to look after pets, but they are very different. It's easier to get really connected with animals than it is with plants, in my personal opinion. But.
Yeah, I was not a big fan of this this task of watering all these plants. That was above my skill set at the time, and I truly think it remains above my skill set now. So anyways, that's my little anecdote. But that was a great background. Thanks for sharing that with us. One little known fact that I know about you is that this year, so, you know, 10 years ago, young kids, you took on this big project of some more education. This year, you took on a project of getting your first book published on Kindle. And I understand that book's title is Horse Body Condition and Weight Analysis, a Comprehensive Study on RCMP Horses. Tell me how this fits into the whole history and life plan.
Yeah, well, horses are my passion. My parents are still a little annoyed that my first word was horse and not mom, dad. Yes. And it's been a passion my entire life. So that's like, I've owned them. I've worked with them in many capacities. I'm not an excellent rider by any means, although I have ridden quite a few times. But my passion has been in, from that auction barn background, buying horses that were, you know, headed through the auction that I thought could be rehabilitated and sort of, you know, find a new career, a new home, as opposed to where they might end up and going through auction. And so I cultivated that passion that way. When I was in doing my undergrad work, I pestered my professors at the McDonald campus of McGill University, to the point where when I'd put my hand up, they'd be like, Corleen, I don't know what that has to do with horses, but I wanted all of my studies to somehow relate to that passion. And although I don't have a career now directly in the horse industry, and I don't want to insult anybody by suggesting that, that's just because I like to work with horses and not always the horse people, no insult intended. It's just the horses that drive me. So I work elsewhere. But when I wanted to do my master's, I had wanted to do it for years and years. I picked the wrong timing. So any young listeners out there, like, do it right after your bachelor's degree. Don't wait until don't wait till you're working full time and you have two small children, because that's not the ideal time to also be working on a master's. But nonetheless, when I did, you know, finally take that plunge and decide to go into it, I wanted it to be related to horses. And sort of in the interim of those two, one of the jobs I had was lecturing at the Kempville campus of the University of Guelph in equine nutrition. And I also did dairy nutrition, genetic selection, because again, that passion piece. And through that work, I forced students. So if they're listening, this is like a trigger for them, but I required that students learn how to calculate rations, to understand how to properly feed horses. And nowhere in the literature at that point was there any studies that said, because when we look at a horse, we say, their body condition score is this, and we assign a number, but we also know what the ideal is, but it's never been related to, okay, but to change it from where they are now to where you want their score to be, they have to gain X number of pounds. And by knowing how many pounds they have to gain, then you know how to calculate the ration accordingly for weight gain or weight loss. So it's a bit of a nerdy nutrition study. So that's why I wanted to do what at the time was the first of its kind research on correlating those two components, body, you know, changes in body condition score with changes in body weight. To do that, you have to have a fairly decent data set, similar animals under similar workloads, but also the potential for body weight and condition to change over time. And the one group close to where I am now, which is close to Ottawa, that I could think of that fit that sort of definition, same breed, you know, sort of same genetics, all working in the same program, was the RCMP horses that they used for the musical rides. So, so if you're familiar with that, the musical ride is a fascinating exhibition of precision riding and collective of the RCMP. They breed their own horses. So they actually have their downtown facility, which is technically, I guess, in downtown Ottawa, where the musical ride horses are stabled, and from that's their serves as their home base during the summer months. But they also have a breeding program out west of Ottawa. So I figured, well, the worst they could do was say no. Well, I mean, it's RCMP. I guess the worst they could have done was arrested me. But really, I was just asking a question. If, you know, they would have any objections to me using their horses in a research study, because it really fit the group that I was looking for. And they're like, well, of course, nobody's ever asked. But they are technically the public's horses. So of course you can't.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. And do you know if these little subject horses have had further research done on them, or was this a one and done program after you did the research?
Yeah, I haven't kept track, so I can't say for sure if anybody's ever asked again. It was not as scary an experience as I thought it was going to be. So if they haven't, but you want to research and use horses, may I suggest you just reach out to the barn manager and see if that's possible.
How many horses would they have, just out of curiosity?
Oh, gosh, there was a whole pile of them. And if I were to go back through, I think we used between 20 and 30 horses for part of the study, which was only I can't say the number for sure, but I felt like it was only a fraction of what was housed there at the barn in Ottawa.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. It's a very big, one of those little known facts of Canadian history and the musical ride and all the stuff that's sort of behind that, right? Like we don't hear about that. It's fascinating because you just don't hear about that. You see the musical ride, you hear the story, but you don't know all of the, you know, all of the stuff in the background. So nice little anecdote. Well, I'm really glad that you were able to, you know, get a book published on your passion project, and that it's actually something like, it's interesting that it's been a passion of yours basically your whole life. And that even though you're working with sheep or in, you know, focused on that, you still have the opportunity to kind of take a little side road and dive into the horse world a bit. So that's really interesting. I don't know that I've ever had a guest on the podcast who has had a Kindle book published. So congrats on that.
Thank you. Yeah, it was just one of those things I did for me, you know, even if it doesn't generate an extensive revenue stream, it wasn't about that. It was more about taking something I'd done and sharing it, because again, I haven't kept track in those past 10 years if anything equivalent had happened, but at least it's a useful piece of information for people who are nerdy about calculating rations.
I also think it's a really great lesson for our listeners that we can have these, you know, little hidden parts of ourselves that we don't necessarily see in our day-to-day work, like these passion projects. And I've had so many guests on this podcast who've talked about, you know, different passion projects that are important to them. And I think that's a really important part of who we are and how we show up, and being able to keep those passions alive, I think, is part of what makes us unique and human. So I'm glad that you were able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
So I want to turn back to the Canadian Sheep Federation. And one of the things that I know about that organization, and you and I have spoken about this before, is that some years ago, the Canadian Sheep Federation incorporated a wholly owned subsidiary that I understand is a for-profit entity. And it's really focused on agriculture technology products and on the development of that development of agritech. Can you tell me a little bit about what that entity is doing, and also why you incorporated it as a subsidiary? And I'm interested in that because I think many of our listeners, many of our entrepreneurs can struggle a little bit with, I don't want to oversimplify it, but sort of the form and substance. And so they have these ideas and they think, hey, I want to innovate here and this, but they run into barriers of potentially being able to access funding or, you know, serving different masters. And I'm just interested to hear the story of how it evolved into its own sort of entity. And has that been a positive experience? Has that, you know, run into some unexpected challenges? Because I think that theme is really important to many of our entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I love to tell the story, and you're right. Like it's not all rainbows and unicorns for sure, because it's not
or horse and sheep.
Rainbows, yes, unicorns, horse and sheep. So let me just go into the history of it, but how it came to pass, because the goal was never originally to, you know, strike a new organization. That
Right.
takes a lot of work. And it especially takes a lot of work for a not-for-profit to have a subsidiary of any kind, let alone a for-profit version. But the backstory to that is part of our work at the Canadian Sheep Federation, our responsibility is to respond to new regulations in Canada and how they affect our producers and provide tools to help, you know, our producers engage with those regulations, be compliant with them, and at the same time, not being a burden. So this particularly, like our work specifically through our subsidiary has been related to traceability, because at the CSF, as the national industry group, we're kind of the go-to between industry and government when it comes to traceability, the regulations, which is about identifying animals and understanding and tracking where they move, so that if we have a disease outbreak, we can more rapidly respond to that. Twofold. One, in case it's zoonotic and affects people, we certainly want to be responsive and responsible. But also from a producer perspective, we just want to save animals' lives.
Right.
From a welfare perspective, obviously, from a farm's future and viability perspective. And I'm careful how I phrase that, because the farm is not just about dollars. I mean, farmers hope to generate a revenue to support their families, like the rest of us do, by driving, or in my case, I'm fortunate enough to walk to the office from the house, but that's the goal. But farmers tend to have it more about their life, right? So a breeding program, your herd or flock, is years and years of concentrated effort to do the best job that you can. And if you have to lose those animals, and by that I mean if it's a reportable disease, those animals could be, required to be destroyed by regulation and federal regulators, you've lost your life's work. And we talked about passion earlier, right? So it's critically important to our producers to be part of an effective traceability system, not just for what it means for other people, but what it means for them and their future of their farm. So our role is to, with current trace regulations that have been in place for a number of years and new ones that are coming in shortly, another year, maybe year and a half, 2 years. That's always a moving target with regulations, but nonetheless, we're actively working towards that. We wanted to create new tools to support the producers, make it easy for them to comply with the regulations, make the system more effective at its goal of quickly and rapidly tracing animal movements in a disease outbreak. And we also had producers saying, well, we want our trace system like to do something for us. Because if you think of it, you're building a trace system just for regulations, it's like an insurance policy. Yeah. You'll always be paying for it, but you never get anything back from it unless you have a disaster, but you hope you never have a disaster so that you never get anything back from it. So, so they're saying, well, exactly. But the comment is, and it's true, if we're connecting everybody in the supply chain, because now as animals move, everybody has to report something, can't we use that system to share valuable product or animal information as they move through the supply chain? So for years, we've been working on this request by industry for traceability to do more, to provide more value back to its users while being effective. And the reality was, we didn't have or see in the marketplace anywhere, having explored a number of different options, a tool that fit that need. So we decided, how hard could this be? We'll just build one. As it turns out, a little harder than the board conversation around, let's just develop one. But we started that in 2019. We decided to build our own, incorporate some new technology, right? If you're going to build something new, why base it off technology from 20 years ago? We may as well start with new and emerging technologies, and sort of test them in that space. We are, some people call us a small industry, as a sheep industry. I like to consider us nimble, but also a perfect test case for bringing in some new ideas, right? So because we're flexible and we are nimble in terms of size and the number of people involved. So it's an opportunity to do that. So in 2019, we started testing blockchain applications in a trace system. And by starting testing, I mean, we started let's go to a processing facility that uses nominal technology. And let's see if we were to try and apply that technology in that setting, how successful would it be? We don't want our stakeholders to have to change how they do business to adopt the technology. We want the technology to fit to how people do business. The goal is to make it less complicated to do and not more.
Yep.
So then, so that worked out fabulously. We were shortly after we did our sort of field trial, we were contacted by the community of federal regulators. They had been tasked by the Prime Minister or the Prime Minister's office. I want to be careful. I don't want to single anybody out, but to explore the use of blockchain and cloud-based technologies in regulated spaces. And so our field trial had been one of those first sort of blockchain applications where we had tested it. So we undertook sort of a use case study with the community of federal regulators, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. It was conducted by Deloitte Digital or Deloitte Technologies. Sorry if I got that wrong. And it was a glowing review of this is how we should be doing traceability in the now and into the future. So that was a green light for us to start fulsomely developing that technology. And we've spent then the last number of years since then, I think 2020 was the end of the use case study. And that's when we said, let's do it, we'll build. And so we built the technology. And it's our AgriLedger is the name of our traceability system. It's enabled with blockchain. It has the capacity to support our existing regulations in Canada, future regulations in Canada. It has built-in data analytics so that we can do rapid disease tracking. So in 30 seconds or less, we can, if we know an infected animal, we can trace all the premises that it's farms that it's been in, or premises, auction barns, feedlots, what have you. All the animals it's come in contact with, all the animals those animals have come in contact with, and every vehicle that it's traveled on. And that allows us to very, very quickly respond. But it also then allows the ability to move production information about that animal across the supply chain, not personal information, but things that are good to know. Is the animal raised in some assurance program, whether that's, you know, or collecting treatment records? Has it ever been treated with antibiotics or never? Or has it demonstrated resistance? There's so many things that the next person in that supply chain and potentially all the way out to the consumer can know very specifically. So that's what we built. Not hard, a couple of years. And then we did some cool, fun things to help sort of with data collection and automate or make data collection more autonomous. That means, how do we get data more easily into the system without people having to do the work, right? Data entry or transcription of paper-based reports, data integrity is really important. All of those types of processes, including file transfers. So typing numbers into a system, when an individual, each animal's ID is 15 digits long and it's unique to every animal. Imagine getting that right if you're putting 400 animals on a trailer.
I can't imagine that I would get two of them right.
Exactly. So we have RFID tags and readers, but that still requires you get close to the animal, you capture the data, you transfer files. It's too much work. So we started working on biometric assessment for unique animal ID. Basically, what that means is facial recognition for sheep as one of those options, so that you could, with your cell phone or a simple networked camera, collect that information without having to punch it in. And it's done automatically. And the beauty of most of the devices with you would use to capture that information is they also date stamp, time stamp, geolocate where the event happens. Those are all your other critical pieces of creating a report around traceability, and just instantly report them to the system. So you don't have those transcription or, you know, a data transfer errors. You don't have a delay between when the information is written down and when it's reported to the system. And then we worked on, you know, understanding that we have elements of our industry that still mostly religious reasons use paper. They don't use or access technology. We want to make the system accessible to them. We still need to digitize that information, both by law, but also for the sake of incorporating it into that fast tracking that we do within the system. So we built some optical character recognition technology specifically trained for the types of data that we collect, so that if somebody sends us a piece of paper, we can digitize, make a digital twin of it in the system almost immediately. And so that's the story why we built technology as a sheep industry, right? But then we also appreciated that we only undertook the development of those technologies because we couldn't find them in existence in the way that we needed, built for what we needed to do. And there became an increasing interest from groups and sectors outside of our own and what those technologies could mean for them. But the Canadian Sheep Federation is a not-for-profit organization. It's funded by producers, and so our dollars are committed to doing work for producers. It didn't allow us to do sort of any sort of work outside our own sector. You know, if another country or another industry groups wants to use that technology, we wouldn't be able to work on it using our right. dollars. But at the same time, it was the Canadian Sheep Federation that invested its own resources. We didn't get any funding. People didn't have oh. any faith in our ability to develop technology. Sorry.
Didn't you show them?
So didn't we show them that we can do it nonetheless. And as it turned out, it was to our advantage. Usually federal funding, no offense to my AFC colleagues, but those contribution agreements, if you get, you know, fund these dollars from the funding pools, they have clauses in them that allows the funder to retain intellectual property rights,
right.
which yep. then makes it impossible, really, to yep. commercialize those. So our theory was we built them for us. Other people could use them. Every farming organization in Canada and probably around the world understands how funding dollars are always tight. Yep. And generating revenue is not something not-for-profits generally think of. But we know that to seek funding from elsewhere is sometimes tied with priorities that aren't always our industry's priorities. And our sheep industry would like to use dollars for research that's important to it, for yes. initiatives and programs that are important to our producers. And if they don't align with federal funding pools, we can't access those. And as a smaller industry group, we already are challenged with accessing funding opportunities. So why not take the technology that we developed and be able to commercialize it, but not using CSF dollars, just using its own revenue stream. But then in any revenue that one might be able to generate through that subsidiary, create a revenue stream back to the not-for-profit who originally created it. So we create a dependable revenue stream for the industry from the good work that it's already done. So that's why a subsidiary, now it's wholly owned by the Canadian Sheep Federation. That's a harder process than just saying, I'm going to start a new company because it does require. Yeah, it requires that you have a special members meeting so that your members of the not-for-profit vote on it. So you had to establish governance structures that would be acceptable, required a special meeting, special members vote to allow us to do that. And we were really pleased that it garnered unanimous support from all of the members around the table, seeing it as that potential to generate reliable revenue for Canadian sheep farmers and ranchers. So that's sort of the history. You had asked in your question, like, what were the challenges? And the challenges are some people don't understand that governance, that ownership right. model, right? So right. you get those that don't understand it suggesting that, you know, there's a group of people trying to capitalize and make dollars off the work the CSF did. And that's not at all the case. And right now, our subsidiary, which is called Prove It Technologies, hasn't done any work outside of the sheep industry yet. It's not to say we don't want to.
Right.
But I'm a little, like, I'm not a very good CEO in the corporate technology world because I've been to a lot of these, you know, innovation summits and that sort of thing. Everybody's talking about what they can do. We can do this and our technology can do that. And I would rather show people what it actually does instead of talking about what it could do. I think there's a polite expression you know, just ensuring that there's a less polite, what is it? Don't let your mouth write a check. Anyway, I won't finish that one, but that's right. a little on the computer side of it. But we want to be able to demonstrate that what we've built has a purpose and actually works. I'm not really good at selling something that will never materialize. And I see too much of that in the ag tech world. And so our focus is on getting our technology fit for purpose in the sheep industry, getting it approved. So our trace system requires sort of a formal approval process because it's used in a regulated space. So right. seeing that happen, that's our first priority. Once that's accomplished, it is accomplished, and we are confident in what we've built for our own sake, then the focus becomes on commercializing it for value to the sheep industry who built it. So for anybody who's misconstrued why that connection between that two organizations exist, that is precisely it. It is, from a not-for-profit perspective, a really unusual approach to creating a revenue stream for your not-for-profits, right? And so now when we work with our other industry groups, agriculture writ large and livestock production is kind of a small group of people.
Sure.
Yep. It feels like a lot around a table, but there's not a lot of, not a lot of people ultimately. But when we sit in those groups and they talk about, well, how are we going to fund? What's next year's budget going to look like? I'm now saying, take what you know and what you do really well and find a way to turn that into your revenue stream to support yourself so you can be independent, so you can be sustainable, so you can work on priorities that mean something to your industry, not to some funder who's putting out dollars who will only do so if it aligns with their priorities. And sometimes those are the one and the same, and that's great. And sometimes they are not. So, anyway, that's a very long story about why
it's
somebody old like me, who's an animal scientist, develops technology.
No, you know, there's so much there to unpack, but I just want to pick up on the comment about sort of the sustainability of the not-for-profit organization, because separate and apart from sort of agri-tech proper, that is a really common challenge that I think not-for-profit organizations are faced with, where, you know, for many years they have had these budgets, they've had these expectations that they'll receive a certain funding amount or grants or whatever the case is. And they develop their programs and their services based on what their funding is. And there's always this terror that they live with of, well, what happens if my budget gets cut? Which program is the first one that's going to, you know, have to be shelved? What priority are we not going to meet? Whereas the ones that are positioned for success are the ones that are saying, how can I make my organization sustainable regardless? And not entirely. Of course, there needs to be that tie to industry organizations, because that's the world that not-for-profits live in. But how can I make my organization sustainable? And what are the members or the stakeholders that are important to this organization? What are they interested in? And where are the opportunities? Where are the opportunities for collaboration, for joint ventures, for commercializing technology, for all kinds of things? Everything that you just described, the ones that are innovative, the ones that are progressive, are the ones that are thinking about answering those questions. So I think it's a really interesting example and technology is a great solution. It's not the only solution for creating sustainability and ongoing viability, but it's a really interesting technology. The other thing that I really was interested in your story was the different pillars. There was a whole bunch of different things that really had to come together in order for your technology to be where it is today, in order to have evolved. And I think, and you touched on a number of them. You were very thoughtful. Your organization was very thoughtful about, well, what can we do? So not the pipe dream, 27 million, feet in the air, but what can we do with the organization that we have, with the people that we have, with the funding dollars or lack thereof that we have? And let's not bite off more than we can chew. Let's get that proof of concept in a way that is really meaningful to us. And then let's responsibly execute on, you know, the further developments. And I'm sure the sky is the limit in terms of where the technology can go and, you know, its applications. But I think that many organizations fall into that trap of not being quite as disciplined as what you've described in terms of the next step and what do we need to do and who do we need to be, you know, accountable to in order to really have success. And then, you know, it can really spiral out of control. So I think that many of the aspects that you talked about, you demonstrated in your story, all the different things that had to come together. But there was a lot of conditions that really were right. Like the fact that you are a small organization, you could pivot if things weren't going well. You knew the problem that you were trying to solve, and you weren't trying to solve all problems. You were trying to do it in a very responsible and diligent way. So I think that has a lot to do with why 5 years after you started that project, it's had some success and, you know, still a ways to go in terms of, as you say, you had additional challenges too with like the regulated space that not all organizations would have to deal with, but you're definitely on the path to success. You're on the continued path to success. I want to tell you about this anecdote and I want to compare it. It's not an agriculture specific example, but years ago, I was working with this with an entrepreneur and they had a similar organization. I don't think they were a not-for-profit, but they had this idea about, or they had the similar challenge as what you described in terms of collecting data in a consistent and thoughtful manner where there was all kinds of opportunity to get it wrong when you're manually inputting things and you have different people inputting it. And they were actually not, they weren't working with sheep. They weren't working with any animals. They were actually working with garbage. And this guy had this idea to put this RFID tag on the garbage trucks. And he had this idea because he had this thought that there was a lot of stuff in that ends up in our landfill that shouldn't be there. And that could be heavy metals. That could be all kinds of things. And his RFID tag was connected to some technology that they had developed that would measure those things. And so they had this idea that, well, we're going to measure all this stuff as the garbage, you know, truck drives around and it collects garbage. And before it goes to the landfill, we're going to have this report. We're going to use all this information. And it did. It did that beautifully. And it exceeded those expectations. But the unexpected part and where his business went in this completely different direction, he had done what you did, which was incorporate this subsidiary, because he knew he would be gathering this data. And he had this inkling that other people might be interested in that data for reasons that he couldn't imagine. And what the biggest use of that technology ended up being was workplace productivity, because these garbage trucks, apparently, I was never on one of them, so I don't know this for sure, but these garbage truck drivers in, you know, rural, wherever they were driving, they would, this RFID tag would track how long they spent at the Tim Hortons. And sometimes the Tim Hortons stops would be like 6 out of 8 hours. And so they had no way of, you know, short of, and this was 15 years ago. So, you know, the technology wasn't as evolved as it is today. And they had no real way of sort of, you know, tracking those things, or they couldn't put all the pieces together about what was actually happening. But that's what the tool, it did all the things that it was meant to do. And that was great. But in addition, they found this way. And sometimes that was because the truck was broken or there was like all these different things. And sometimes it's just because the truck driver liked donuts too much. Like there was just, you know, no other way to say that. But they ended up gathering the data and essentially selling the data completely unrelated to the initial purpose of measuring the heavy metals and doing all these things. But that was a market-driven need or a market-driven purpose. And so they said, okay, well, we have our garbage stuff. We know what's going on over here. We're going to set up another company. So this data company, they called it Data Co. And Data Co can do whatever it wants. So when the market tells us we want to track how many donuts our truck drivers are eating or whatever the case is, they could then generate this revenue stream by licensing that bundle of data and not how many diapers and how many heavy metals. And they didn't care about that. And so they had that flexibility to be able to really respond in an industry or in an application that was completely unrelated to the initial sort of garbage technology that they were developing. And when you were telling your story, I couldn't help thinking, hey, this is very similar. The way that you've set this up is actually very similar, that there could be maybe horses, maybe other animals, maybe other countries whose regulatory framework is probably similar, but not identical. And they might maybe able to package the technology, the components in a way that isn't what you intended in the first instance. But because of the flexibility and because of the ability to capture the data that you've inherently built into your system, they can use it for purposes above and beyond sort of what you have intended. So I couldn't help but think of the parallel in the story that you were telling. And it's quite industry agnostic, but I think that's the beauty of the story that you just told, is that it's not so specific that this would only ever apply in the sheep industry.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I've got to do another interview on Friday, talk about digital transformation. I think we talked a little bit about how we've accomplished the things we have is by working with students and academic institutes on various projects, pulling in sort of that expertise, because clearly I'm not the technology person in the room. I'm the animal scientist, and I understand the regulations, and I know where the pieces have to fit. But anyway, I did some work with some MBA students at University Canada West and on digital transformation, and they thought, our story was an interesting one. And it is essentially transforming, using technology, digital technology primarily, to transform the way we do business. And the fun part about being involved in that, and this is what I find probably the most exciting about working on technology, besides the young people and their brilliant ideas, is as soon as you accomplish one thing, then you think, oh my gosh, I can also do this, and I can also do this, and I can also do this. And it builds so quickly. So like our facial recognition also can do welfare assessment, also can do
Very
this sort
cool.
of thing and that sort of thing. And you have to get like that first step in and the first step working, and then you realize. And so we've between students, and we also have some early adopters, people that we asked to play with our technologies and work with them. It's fun to watch that too, because they have the same progression, which is, yeah, it does this thing great. Wait a minute, can it also do this? And can it also do that? And then we can find ways to digitally transform not only how we collect data and how we manage data, but then how we can use that to improve what we're doing. And for me, that's like what we hope our tool does, not just fit the regulation, not just help people
Of
be
course,
compliant, do it
of course.
easier, but now as a as an individual producer or business, regional organization or national organization, now we know all sorts of things about our industry that we didn't know, or our business or our region, that help us improve and move forward. And so, it's a bit of a movement. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself and say it's, that exciting and transformative. There's lots of digital technology already in existence. It's connecting those usefully that's really meaningful. But yeah, I appreciate how you set out on a path, you think you know the path, and then it swerves or branches. And I think you have to have the right people around you to both recognize where the opportunities are and temper. So I have some great people. I'm so fortunate that our board from then till now has been open to trying new things, because I assure you, when you say we're going to incorporate blockchain and tracing sheep, there's some little squints around the table. Then you're like, let's look at facial recognition. And they think you have three heads when you bring it up, but they have been good at allowing some leeway in that, because our little successes have suggested we're not always on the wrong path. We may actually have gotten that idea right, but very fortunate for some forward-thinking people. They do get a little ahead of themselves, like we were just talking about, and being like, oh my gosh, like we could do all of these things. And my suggestion is we probably could, but how about we focus on our strengths? And our strengths are that we understand our industry, right? We know the problem that we're trying to fix and the way that our industry wants to fix it. And I find in, and I don't mean any disrespect, like I'm all for people trying to innovate in agriculture and bring different technologies, and I think it's fantastic. What sometimes happens, and I see goes wrong, and we're seeing this sort of in the market. I listen to Bloomberg all morning to try and feel smart about business acumen. Doesn't always work, but shout out to Bloomberg.
It's got to start somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. We're seeing some changes in sort of investment in tech and tech startups as well. In the ag tech space, just too many people have an idea about a technology that they think will fix how farmers or agribusinesses do something, without really understanding what the something is that they do. And our story is fun from a not-for-profit side. As an ag tech startup, we don't fit the mold, and we're not people's first choice for investment, right? They're like, well, you're the sheep industry. Why would we, like, okay, so you have some technology. Why would that be investable? Well, I mean, it fits, it works, it's proven. It's not an idea I started out by saying I'm not super keen on talking about things I can't deliver or I'm not confident that I can deliver. I'd rather deliver them and then we can talk about them. But there's a lot of the opposite. Here's all the things this can do. It can solve this problem, and somebody has to change a process or the way they do business, or you know, or create a problem for that technology to solve and not the other way around. So yeah, we've had to temper some people saying these are the things that we're really good at. We'd also like investors to know we're not kidding when we say these technologies work. We are the proving, right? And there's
I love that the name is Prove It, because that's what you're all about, right?
Yeah, exactly. Look, we have found we're good at developing technology. Put our groups around the table to find a name for something. That is the hardest part of any job. So coming up with Prove It was a long fought battle to just figure out any name. Not that people didn't like it, just yeah, that was the tricky part. But we're proud of that, because we are about, you know, Prove It's about traceability systems and demonstrating that. And so it was a decent fit.
That's a really good segue. I wanted to ask you, and you've touched on this a little bit, but I want to ask you, sort of the non-technology person that you said you were at the beginning of this journey. What are your predictions for the shift in technology that you think we're going to see in the next 5-10 years, and what the effect will be specifically for animal health?
Yeah, I feel like I'm standing on a hill shouting a message and people aren't listening too much, but you and I have talked about this. So I'm an animal person. That's my focus. Right. I believe in livestock production for producing food. Some people think that means I don't love animals, but I really do. And I think that while they're here and while we're raising them, we need to do the best job possible as producers. And I think most producers and the industry would agree with me. Like, we spend a lot of time talking about animal health and animal welfare. We do see a lot of conversations around sustainability in agriculture and agriculture's role in mitigating climate change and goals towards net zero. I'm really disappointed that so few people have picked up on the critical importance that animal health and welfare plays in climate change, not the other way around. So lots of conversations around how when temperatures change and you know, you have vector-borne diseases, that's the word I was looking for. So those spread by insects or other animals, zoonotic diseases, and their change in migration patterns. So we saw, you know, avian influenza and dairy cattle on the US side. So we see that, we talk about that. We don't talk about how animal health and animal welfare has an impact on the climate, and how as livestock producers, we can demonstrate mitigating our climate change impact by improving animal health and welfare. And so I really want to champion that. And I think it needs to be more incorporated into the conversation around sustainability and the future of food supply. Critically important. And it just comes down to like the simple bare facts of how you raise an animal. They consume resources. Those resources turn into food and food supply. If an animal gets sick, it consumes more resources and provides less output. If you've put resources into them for any period of time and they die, it's food loss, right? We often don't think of it in those terms, but in reality, that's what it is. It's just early food loss, as opposed to once it's a product on a shelf, food loss.
Yep.
And that has not been enough of a focus in the sustainability conversation. So I see that as being really, really important to recognize, to create measures that improve animal health. So that's everything from ensuring we have animal vaccines and animal treatments that cut down on antimicrobial use, but keep animals healthier, and policies around well-being and welfare of animals. We work closely in that in our organization. The sheep industry has a sheep code of practice for the care and handling of sheep. Well, obviously, we wouldn't do horses, so we'll let the horse people do the horses. But
they
we
probably have one too.
Yeah, exactly. Not only because it's important that the animals are healthy and happy in their life, but it's also important from that sustainability perspective. So we are involved in all of those, but we need to be able to do more, getting more products available to producers, providing them more with more tools around animal health and welfare. Essentially, our traceability technology comes down to that, right? Rapid mm-hmm. response to disease means fewer animals get sick, fewer animals die, more animals remain available in the food supply system. So that's my soapbox, if you will. Where I see technology going in terms of that is, I think, I don't want to give away all my secrets. I might lose my next business model, but I don't mind sharing because it is important. I see the work we do in biometrics right now as just a stepping stone. So facial recognition or gait analysis or body condition scoring, pairing, that's a lot of what we see in this biometric space as really, really good and cool, but a stepping stone because it's still it's still evaluating some physiological expression of well-being. In other words, the animal's demonstrating a change in their well-being and we're responding to that. And in my personal opinion, that's still too late, right? It's by the time the animal does that, they have contracted a disease or an illness or an ailment, or they're suffering from it and we see it. AI may allow us to see it slightly earlier than person may, and only if you're not a good stock person. If you're a good stock person, you should be able to, you are able to come into the barn and or into the paddock and understand pretty quickly when you've got a problem and when you haven't. AI is just meant to be good like that when you can't be at all places at all times. But it's still a response. And I think there is tremendous opportunity to be far more proactive. So personally, I would like to see us move towards more sensor technology and not wearable external sensor technology. Internal biodegradable nano sensors. I'm still looking for somebody to develop those. But if we could, from inside an animal in a very safe and humane way, obviously, and I think that's possible, to detect viral loads, white blood cell counts, internal body temperature changes, any number of parameters, and signal that, that's the early detection of a disease. Allows us to be, you know, a week to 10 days ahead of the curve in identifying that there's an issue, as opposed to simply reacting to the fact that they're now showing it. Because if you talk, for example, like foot and mouth disease, when we create a trace system, it's the gold standard against which we say, how quickly can we control foot and mouth with this disease? And if the answer is really, really quickly, then that's, we've established that standard for our systems. Those lesions that we see, that we physically see, which is how you would first identify an animal's having foot and mouth disease, I mean, the animal's been infected for 7 to 10 days. And by the time they've been infected, they've been shedding that infection to other animals. Right. What if we knew that at day 2 instead of day 7 or day 10?
Right.
And I think there's tremendous opportunity for that. We can already... I think I shared this with you last time. If I didn't, I will now. But and I thought this was the coolest thing ever. I spoke to a company about how we can actually create, we could have sensors and a whole flock of sheep out in the countryside, nowhere close to a barn or a receiver. And we can make a mesh network of those animals through one or two sentinel animals that have a transponder to transmit the satellite to signal, the signal to satellite, and then that gets bounced to your server, and then it analyzes the data and detects in real time. Or if you're in a barn, you can do it even easier, obviously, because you can have those sort of fixed receivers on spot. So I think that's where we have the capacity to go. It's not as far-fetched a thought as some might think. Like there's cool, for example, in human health, biodegradable sensors that they can input in the brain to detect pressure in cases of concussions or brain injuries. And if my understanding of those sensors is correct, they degrade over time based on heat. So they're short-lived, might not fit our solution. So all we need to do is get the sensors, folks. If somebody wants to design a sensor, if not, I'll just set out on my own. I've already got a... I've already got a friend of my son's who's in biotechnology of some sort. She has to do her fourth year assignment on some novel technology. So she's said that she's going to try and build me a nanosensor. But I see that's where
that'd be cool.
Right. And so we again, people think I'm a little too far out in my thinking and getting too far ahead of myself. But the value of that is not about having the most cutting edge cutting edge technology. Certainly, I haven't earned anything more than my normal salary from doing these sorts of things. So I'm not in it to make big dollars, although making dollars is not a dirty word. I'd like to someday. But the goal would be to allow our producers to be collecting data, because they've already got so many things they have to do in a day, so many regulations they have to meet and chores they have to do. And it's hard to get skilled labor to help contribute and tend towards that. So how can we just collect information that they can then interpret and turn into decision-making that allows us as an industry to be more productive, our stakeholders to be more profitable, and our food supply to be more sustainable in the long term? And that's really, I have no ulterior motives than hoping that the farmers that I grew up admiring continue to be successful. And the world has to eat. And if you didn't grow a tomato today or a potato or raise a chicken in your backyard, somebody's going to have to do it for you. And so we want to make sure that our producers are around to be those people.
Well, that's a lot of those are some ambitious goals, but I am confident that that you and the team that you're working with and others will be able to accomplish that. I want to ask you one more question. So in 2023, CEO Monthly named you as the Livestock Software CEO of the Year in North America. And in 2024, CEO Monthly named you the most pioneering ag tech CEO in 2024. So first of all, congratulations on that recognition and the validation of all of your efforts and your leadership. With that recognition, what do you hope your legacy will be on the industry through the innovative way of shaping what you've worked on?
Oh, that's a big one. And I don't know that I've even thought about what I want my legacy to be. Because I've never thought about my work in terms of my own legacy. I've thought about my work as just contributing to the success of our industry and the people in it. So if anything, if people could look back and say she did the best she could with what she had and the resources available to her, and she made a difference for the next generation, I think that's the best that I could hope for at this part. I have a title of CEO Approve It, Executive Director for the CSF, and I've never taken those to mean anything more than I'm just part of a team. Because that's really what we are here at the CSF, is just a team of people trying to do the right thing every day. And at Prove It Technologies, I think I've alluded to earlier, working with universities and students and summer interns. When I work with them, I just hope that one day they can look back at it and say, well, she really helped me get a meaningful job or have a meaningful future. Not that she was meaningful or her job is meaningful, but she helped me make mine that way. And in the position that I'm in, I sometimes get painted as the bad guy. Sometimes I earn it because I have to advocate for our industry. So from my government colleagues who are like, oh my God, she's at this meeting again and we're going to have to deal with Corlina. But it's really intended to, I don't know, support the industry that I love. So I don't think I'll make it rich from that. But I can sleep with myself at night knowing that I actually did do the best job that I could every day with the tools that I had.
That is an amazing legacy, because there are many in this world who can't say that. So I think that's an amazing legacy. Where can our listeners find out more about the work that your organization is doing?
Yeah, well, you can find our cansheep.ca website. It talks about the Canadian Sheep Federation. And we use our Facebook page a lot because we have a nimble budget, just like the size of our industry. Yes. So we like to use that social media platform for sharing information. You can find more about me, not that I'm that interesting, or Prove It Technologies. Thank you. You can find me at Corlina Patterson on LinkedIn or Prove It Technologies on LinkedIn. That's where we share some of our advances and the work that we're working on. And on there, you'll find my email address. I'm never too busy to answer any question or have a chat about what we do and why we do it with anybody who wants to reach out.
Amazing. That's incredibly generous. And you've been incredibly generous with your time today to help us understand about what the Canadian Sheep Federation is doing and the innovation and the sustainability initiatives that the for-profit entity has been created. So thank you very much for taking time and speaking with us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you, Heather. And again, thank you for the invitation to be part of it. I'm honored. It's surprising because, like I said, I didn't come into my job or the things I do looking for any special sort of recognition. So the invite in itself was a lot for me. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Of course, it was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to Women in Leadership and Entrepreneurship to stay updated with our latest episodes. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and share it with others who might find it valuable. Until next time. Dentons is a global legal practice providing client services worldwide through its member firms and affiliates. This episode does not constitute legal or other advice. You should not take or refrain from taking action based on its content. Please contact a legal practitioner to obtain advice with respect to any legal matter. Please see dentons.com for legal notices.